So welcome to This Cycling Life. Today, I'm super happy to be joined by Sam Bewley. Sam has had a very diverse and interesting career, picking up the bike as a teenager, having experienced success at the national level, both in the individual time trial and then on the track. Commonwealth Game, multiple Olympic medalist, currently riding for the the World Series team, Mitchelton Scott, soon to be Mitchelton something else. But Sam Bewley, welcome to you, and great to have you on the show.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to having a chat with you. I've watched a couple of your recent interviews, so interested to sit down with you and have a good chat.
Good stuff. Hey, Sam, so why don't we start just by talking about how you got into the game? Can you tell us about where you grew up and, you know, when you got your first pair of wheels under you?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Rotorua, a little town in the North Island of New Zealand, and just basically grew up in a family that weren't sports people, but were people interested in sport, and I always grew up around sport, whether it was watching it on TV or, you know, my parents standing on sidelines of rugby games and things like that. So I was just a young kid who, I guess, like a lot of young kids, try my best to get out of classrooms, and that was the way to do that was to play sports. So I was just into sport and tried my hand at everything. And then growing up in Rotorua, which is sort of world renowned for mountain biking, I thought one day I'd give that a crack. I mean, the trails are on the doorstep in Rotorua, so I headed out there with my father one weekend, and basically from there I caught the bug. And slowly over time, all the other sports disappeared into the background, and I got more and more serious with mountain biking. And then into road cycling, into track cycling. So that's basically how the path I went for me.
And Sam, did you realise kind of early on that kind of you had a big engine? I mean, you won the national TT championship on the road as an under 17, I understand. Did it come easy for you when you were younger? Was it a lot of hard work, or was the natural ability kind of always there?
I think the thing that I don't know if I had a big engine, but I was big, which probably helped. I was probably the same size when I was under 17 as I am now. So at that point, and you know, as a youth, when you're growing up and your body's changing, and you know, some people are ahead of the game, and I think I was a little bit in that sense. So I guess it did come a little bit easy for me because of my size and things like that. It obviously got harder and harder as the years went on, and everybody started to develop and get stronger and fitter. But ultimately, like when you're young, I never took it too seriously. I really enjoyed it. And that was how I took it seriously. Basically, I just wanted to ride my bike. I wanted to ride my bike before school, after school, during school, whenever I could get on the bike seat, I was on it. So, I guess in a roundabout way, I was working hard. I was doing a lot of bike riding, and that sort of helped me develop, through the ranks. And it, obviously, as you get better and you have success, you get even more motivated. If you're not, you know, when you suffer, things aren't quite as easy or aren't quite as motivating. So obviously I do a lot of that now, but in my younger years, it sort of kept me really driven and motivated.
Yeah. And I understand Rotorua didn't have a velodrome, because you started out on the mountain bike and on the road bike. And as I understand it, you were home one evening, you got a call from New Zealand Cycling saying, we want you to come onto the track. So how was that an experience, you know, picking up the track bike, joining, you know, guys who are obviously very experienced? Did you feel a little bit out of your depth there when you first got on the track?
Oh, mate, I had no idea what I was doing. I was going to race the Youth Commonwealth Games on the mountain bike and on the road in Bendigo, actually. So just around the corner from you, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in Shepparton. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was heading over there to race the mountain bike and the road. And I got a call from them saying, hey, well, do you want to have a crack at the track as well? Do you want to ride the individual pursuit and the scratch race? I thought, oh, I don't even own a track bike. I've never even been on the track, but sure, why not? You know, let's get into it. So I got a track bike built by a local bike builder in Rotorua. Just said, I gave my road bike and just said, oh, just, I don't know, same dimensions as that, I suppose. So had no idea what I was doing. And I raced the individual pursuit at the Youth Commonwealth Games. I think I finished fourth. And then I went to Melbourne the following weekend to race Oceania Track Champs. And I won the individual pursuit there. And then that was second year junior. And then from there, I got selected for the Junior Worlds track cycling team. And we went over there and we had success. And then basically in New Zealand, the natural path in track cycling is the biggest component of cycling in New Zealand. So I was from the juniors straight into the senior program and developed through the track program there for a lot of years and stopped racing the track only in 2012.
Yep. And I mean, how was that? I mean, because of course, you know, as an Australian, you know, I grew up in the Southeast and I mean, it's interesting what you say about you being a big guy, because I remember, Sam, I used to hate guys like you, you know, because I was kind of a late developer, you know, I was like, I don't know, 17 years old and about 55 kilos, 165 centimeters tall. And where I grew up in Australia, it was pan flat. And I used to just get massacred by these, you know, these 16, 17 year old kids who are 80 kilograms and built like Tom Bonin. So yeah. I can probably sympathize with the guys you were racing against. But the other thing about, you know, I experienced, Sam, when I was a teenager racing, was that nobody gave a damn, you know, I mean, nobody knew about cycling because everyone was in, where I grew up, it was all Australian rules football, it was cricket. I mean, how was it as a young guy growing up in New Zealand? I mean, going off to the World Championships, even the Olympics, but not really being in a sport that in a way is so well known and respected, I guess, as where New Zealand rugby obviously is massive.
Yeah, and I guess I was, cycling was and still is a minority sport in New Zealand, and it probably always will be. It's definitely growing, but it's still a minority sport compared to rugby and cricket and things like that. But I was lucky that I grew up in Rotorua, where cycling was sort of part of the culture there because of the mountain biking. On a weekend, there was every man and his dog would go out mountain biking. So it was part of the culture in Rotorua. And I was lucky that I went to a school that really celebrated sports. We had a good first 15 rugby side that were multiple national champions and world champions. We had a good cricket side. And the principal of that school, he really celebrated sports. So the fact that I was sure this one guy in a school of 1,500 people that rode a bike, because I had success, I was celebrated for that, and I was given opportunities to go overseas to race the Junior Worlds through the school in year, and they still helped me with my education at the same time. So I was in a really small bubble of New Zealand that kind of understood cycling or understood sports really well. So that was a big thing for me. But obviously, as you leave school and you get older and you start racing in Europe, and then you come home and you try to explain to your friends, oh, what do you do for a job? And I'm a bike rider. You know, I might not be making much money now, but I'm focused on, you know, I've got enough money to get by and focused on trying to improve and become a professional bike rider. They can't wrap their heads around it, because at that point in New Zealand, they didn't really understand that cycling could be a profession. And so it was always dealing with those sorts of situations.
Yep. And how old were you, Sam, when you really thought, you know, I'm really going to try to make a career of this? Because obviously, as I understand it, I mean, you got your first big break with Radio Shack. Was that something you talked about with your parents, with, I don't know, grandparents, friends? I mean, you know, at school, you always have the career advisor, right? So was that something you consciously kind of made a decision at a certain point in your life as a young guy, that look, this is something I really want to have a crack at? Was it a conscious decision, or was it just something that you kind of evolved into?
I loved cycling when I was at school, and I wasn't necessarily, not that I'm unintelligent, but I wasn't motivated by school. So I was always looking at the pathway, like, I don't know what I'm going to do when I leave school, but it's not university. I'm going to pursue bike riding to whatever degree and to whatever end. It might end up going nowhere. It might end up going somewhere. If it doesn't go anywhere, I'll work it out then, you know? But I was really, really into track cycling, and we were having success on the track. And basically the year after I left school, I was already on the radar for the 2008 Olympic Games. So that became my focus to make that selection and then to go to Beijing. So I was thinking about nothing else other than track cycling. And then after the Beijing Olympics, I started racing on the road in America with Trek Livestrong. But even then, I didn't really have any ambitions of being a professional road cyclist, mainly because I didn't really feel like it was a reality for me at that point.
Why was that?
I'd raced amateur in France for a couple of years prior to that, and I hadn't had any success. I hadn't even been anywhere near the pointy end of races. I was enjoying it, but I never once thought, oh, I can really make make something from road cycling. But I was
what were you doing in France, man? There are mountains in France. You should have been in Holland or Belgium. A guy yours, like Matt Heyman, who I spoke to last week, he knew what he was doing. He came straight to Belgium and started mixing it up, you know, with the Rabobank guys in the wind and the flat and the cobbles and stuff. So, but anyway, in the end, it worked out for you.
Yeah, I was there with the national program. We had a national under 23 road program in the south of France. And for me, road cycling was just a tool. It was just something that I needed to do for 6 months of the year to get to have a good track season. And that's how I started doing more and more road and more road overseas, basically just to aid my my season on the track. And I went to America. I started racing quite well on the road over there. I was one of the older guys on the team. And then Lance started Team Radio Shack, and he wanted to bring a couple of guys over from his development team. And at that point in the team, I was one of the oldest guys and one of the more developed guys. So I got the nod, and then all of a sudden I was a professional road cyclist, and I thought, oh shit, how did it end up here? But anyway, let's go.
and so then I mean, you said you'd already spent some time living in France, but as part of the New Zealand program, when did you actually sort of relocate to Europe on your own, and how did you find that as an experience?
2010, so my first year in the world tour with Radio Shack. So I was, for 3 years prior to 2009, I was racing in a couple of years in France and 1 year in Belgium, actually, but with the national program all around the track. And then I raced on the road 2009 in America. And then when I got the job with Radio Shack in 2010, I moved to Girona in Spain permanently, for no other reason that I basically didn't know where to go. Where to live, where to base myself, but I knew a couple of people here, a couple of other Kiwis who were professionals, so I came here for that reason, and I've basically been here ever since.
Yeah, cool. And I mean, you've been now in the game for a while, Sam, and obviously, I mean, you've been a champion in your own right. I mean, in terms of, you know, both at the national, Olympic, Commonwealth level. I mean, you were part of the Green Edge team that won the stage in the Giro Italia as well in the team time trial. I mean, what do you think it takes to, I don't know whether I should say make it, but, you know, what does it take to actually become and then to thrive, do you think, as a pro athlete? What are the ingredients that are needed as an individual?
I think competitiveness is obviously something that comes natural to people. If you're not competitive, you're not competitive. I don't believe that you can flick a switch and all of a sudden become a competitive person. I was always competitive with whatever I did. I still am. Simple game of poker can get me ruffled sometimes. But I think at the start, it's all about enjoyment. I just loved it. I loved being a cyclist. Kiwis naturally are quite intrepid as well. So I love traveling. I love traveling the world. I'm sure my mum didn't like it that as an 18-year-old I left home, but I was, get me on that first flight, let's go and see the world. Yep. And I managed to do that with a bike and meeting a lot of cool people. And and then obviously as you develop and you start having successes at junior level, under 23 level or Commonwealth Games, you start to then push for the next thing. You go, all right, yep, we've won a Commonwealth Games medal, now let's win an Olympic medal. And how are we going to
I'd like to come back to that aspect you talked about, which is, I guess, the enjoyment, because I had another, actually, I was on Dan Jones' Detour podcast a couple of weeks ago, and a good buddy of mine, Bernard Muderman, who is a guy who ran what was called the Cycling Centre here in Belgium for many, many years. He worked with over 1,000 young, aspiring cyclists. And one of the things that Bernard always said that he sensed that was a real differentiator for the New Zealanders, the Australians in particular, who came to Europe, this sense of adventure. Because also in his cycling center, he had the young Belgian guys, Dutch guys, even the Americans. And he said for those guys, it was much more of a, how to put it, more of a job in a way, more of a more of a dream, really, to make it as a cyclist. So it's interesting that you also say that you had this kind of sense of just adventure, and do you think that was just because, I mean, you grew up in a place that was so far away, or that Europe was so exotic for you? I mean, where do you think that sense of adventure came for you personally?
Well, I grew up with a mum and dad who had traveled the world. Mm. And when I was young, I was just so infatuated by their stories and listening to these things they did in all these different corners of the globe in the 80s. And I thought, I have to do that as well. And regardless of whether I was a sportsman or not, I think I would have done it. but I was lucky enough that I got to combine it with my passion and my love at that time, which was cycling. And then once when you come over here and you're on the other side of the world, you know, Spain is, you can't get any further away from New Zealand than Spain. And you come here with a focus and with a vision of trying to make it as a bike rider. And you sort of, when you go to the nuts and bolts of it, you almost haven't got a choice, because you can't go home tomorrow to mum and dad and cry because things didn't work out. Or, you know, you can't call mum and go, oh, I need to, how do I cook this? You have to learn how to live. You have to learn how to survive. And people have invested in you, you know, financially to get you over there. You're not making any money yourself. You're an amateur bike rider. You might be making 300 euros a month. So you've got to have success, because if you don't have success, then you can't buy the next meal. So you constantly go, all right, I've got to work harder than these guys, you know, and I'm in a harder position than the person living at home, the Spanish guy, the French guy, the Belgian guy who's living with his parents. I'm so far away from my parents. So bugger this, like,
But that's interesting. I mean, I guess that comes back to, in a way, what you talked about. It seems to me it's almost like a combination, right? Because you talked about this competitiveness, but of course, there's that wonderful saying, you know, that hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. So, what's your take on that? Because I mean, clearly you have had you've got talent. I mean, you've made it as an Olympic medalist, and you've had other incredible results, but. At the end of the day, you know, sometimes it is just about hard work, is it not? And to what extent is what you're saying that in a way being so far from home gives you that extra motivation to work hard, perhaps compared to, as you say, the local riders who have mum and dad living around the corner and it's easier to fall back? Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because, I mean, for me, Sam, it sounds like, I mean, you clearly were motivated, right? I mean, you were a young guy, you had a big dream, you had this aspiration to travel the world, but also you seem to be talking a little bit about a commitment to give something back. I mean, whether it was to your parents or to your school. For you, how do you think about that balance of, you know, self-motivation versus that motivation that also comes from wanting to make others happy or make others proud of you? How does that balance work for you?
Yeah, well, now that you mentioned it, maybe that's not, I didn't quite get the message across correctly, that I don't think I felt like I needed to give anything back to anybody, because I've always felt that my parents were proud of me regardless of what happened. But I guess what I mean is that when you make the commitment to come to the other side of the world to have a crack at being a bike rider, you're so motivated to do it right and be like, look, I'm here now. I have to do everything I can to make this work. And it may not, but I'm going to leave no stone unturned, because look at the effort I've made to be here. Yeah. I wouldn't have done this if I wasn't motivated to do that. And I think, like you say, you have talent, but I mean, I've never really looked at myself as an extremely talented bike rider. I think that I just come from, Kiwis, I think, are hard workers. I think they always have been. My family were hard workers. So I grew up around that. And when I came here, like I say, I was like, I have to make the most of this opportunity, because it might not happen again, or it might lead to great things. So at that point, you decide, look, I'm going to make sure I do work really, really hard to make the most of this opportunity.
Yeah. Sam, it's always, you know, I'm a big fan of Backstage Pass, you know, and Dan Jones is a personal friend of mine. So I've been following Dan for a long time. But it's interesting that you talked about this enjoyment that you have, because, you know, honestly, man, with some of those Backstage Pass episodes I was watching, I was on the floor laughing with your sense of humor. You know, I call Sam Bewley the stand-up cyclist, because you just seem to bring this, you know, even in the toughest moments. You know, I was watching some of those stages in I think it was the Giro, where Esteban, you know, was having some rough days, or you guys were really trying to do what you could to get him on the podium. And you always seem to have a smile, you know, you always seem to have a joke, you always seem to have a laugh. I mean, to what extent is that, I don't know, joy or humor part of helping you to perform? You know, because I think a lot of people see Sam Bewley as a little bit the joker, the comedian. But some people also that I've spoken to say, well, actually, for me, it's a pressure reliever. You know, it's a way for me to keep my feet on the ground, to deal with stress and to ultimately perform. How do you think about that? I mean, is it just humor just for fun, or does it also help you in some ways to do your job?
I think it helps. I mean, obviously it's who I am. So I think to be yourself helps you anyway. Obviously you have to pick the time. You can't, if something goes wrong on the bike and your team leader loses 20 minutes, when he's finished, sitting second in the Giro d'Italia, you can't just walk on the bus and just straight away start cracking jokes. Like you've got to be a little bit sensitive around some sort of things. But I feel like with my, and I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but this is how I feel about my role as a road captain or someone in the leadership group or elder statesman in the team, whatever you want to call it. Especially in Grand Tours, if things aren't going right, it's really important to keep the spirits high, because if you don't, then it becomes a really shitty few weeks. And even in the face of adversity or things not going your way, like we might be trying to win a Grand Tour and something happens and all of a sudden that's not on the cards anymore and there might be 18 days to go. It's going to be a long 18 days we all sit and sulk. You know, there's still so much that can be achieved in those 18 days. There's stage wins that can be taken. There's a lot of things we can do. And the way that we're going to do that is by everybody going like, right, yeah, let's buy in. Let's go. Let's have a laugh. Let's be energetic. Let's wake up every morning and enjoy getting on the bus with the guys. Enjoy sitting at the dinner table with the guys rather than being like, this is miserable. I want to go home. Because then you're not going to have any success. Then it's just going to be dragging your feet for 18 days. But if you can look forward to going to dinner and sitting there and having a laugh with the boys, and when you finish your meal, no one wants to go back to their room because everyone's enjoying it. You forget what's happened that day on the bike and you go, oh, I'm still enjoying being here. Yeah. So why not make the most of it?
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting, Sam. Cause I mean, the other thing of course is that, you've been under lockdown. You're living on your own there in Girona. You've been in your apartment. And then over the last few months, I've been seeing some very, very funny, little vlogs you've been putting up and some YouTube clips and stuff. Can you talk about that? I mean, what's motivated you to do that? Cause that also seems to me to be a way that Sam Bewley's character is coming out in terms of not just making others laugh, but keeping your spirits up as well. Was that something you did consciously, or that sort of just came along one day as a random thought?
Oh, mate, it was 100% a coping mechanism. That's all it was. Yeah. I was locked in my apartment for 3 months by myself and I was going mental because, like I say, I like to go and sit at these dinner tables and I like to be on the bus with the guys. You know, I like to be in the social situations and I like to be surrounded by my friends and I like to have a laugh. I couldn't do that with anybody other than myself. Mm. And then I realized, not initially, but then I realized that although I'm not necessarily a huge fan of social media in a sense, I did see the appeal of social media during this time, because then I did have an interaction with people, even though it was virtually, and I did have people laughing and people telling me they were found it funny and people saying, oh, look, you've lifted our spirits. And that was lifting my spirits because I was feeling better about making somebody else feel better. And it was a way of having interaction with people without having face-to-face interaction.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting how you've done that. And it certainly seems to have been popular. I mean, you've had thousands of views and hundreds of comments and stuff. So it seems to be going well. Is that something you've now reflected on that you might, invest more time in the future? I mean, clearly you've got an audience that you can actually inspire and make laugh and feel better. And I mean, was that a talent that you realized you had? I mean, besides just your character of having people laugh on the bus and bringing that into the team. But guys like Jens Voigt built their culture, they built their later career on being known for their sense of humor, for their ability to, inspire others and to say the funny cracks in the deepest and darkest times on the bike. Have you reflected about how you might leverage social media as part of your career moving forward?
It's yes and no. I do enjoy the media side of things. I've done I did a few commentary gigs this year. For the tour once I left the tour and for the Giro, and I really enjoyed it. I really did enjoy doing that stuff. With the social media stuff, I don't know. I don't know if I don't mind social media, but I'm not obsessed by the fact that I want to like get 100,000 followers or whatever. Like I don't have that many followers. I might get some of these cooking shows have had 40,000 views, but I've only got 8,000 followers or something. And like I don't really have any motivation to build that following necessarily. Yeah. I just did the stuff because it was fun. It was easy. It gave me actually a little bit of something to do. I might spend an hour going, oh, what am I going to cook tonight and how can I make that funny? or what, you know, what am I, maybe I can clean the shower, or just, you know, just using my brain in a weird way, but using my brain a little bit to do some planning for these things.
Yeah. I'd like to, I guess, I mean, I'd like to come back to that maybe a bit later, because I mean, of course, I know Mitch Docker pretty well, and you know, he's done pretty amazing things actually with his life in the Peloton, and actually understanding actually the potential impact of social media when used well. Because you know, when you see someone like Mitch, it's not about narcissism, it's not about showing off, it's just about, you know, his character and actually connecting people and inspiring people. So, but maybe let's come back to that in a second, because what I'm also curious to talk about is the fact that, you know, you have been living on your own, you've been in Europe for a long time now. And you've had your setbacks. I mean, maybe you'd like to show everybody what you're wearing on your arm right now, right? I mean, you've just had surgery on your wrist. I mean, how do you, you know, lift yourself up when you get knocked down as a rider? And is that something that you've learned from a young age, and is being far from home part of that? But it must be tough. I mean, you've been through lockdown. Now you've been through a pretty serious injury. What are the tactics or techniques that you use personally to just lift yourself up and have that fortitude to continue?
That's a really tough one to answer. And I don't know. I don't really know. I have had a lot of injuries over my career. None of them have ever been so serious that I've had to, you know, been staring down the barrel of 6 months off the bike or anything like that. But they've always required rehab, always required a comeback of sorts. And I sort of feel like it's just almost a little bit ingrained in me now because of the fact I've had so many. And I don't really know what the medicine is or what it, you know, what the secret is, but I guess it's your job. You're a professional bike rider, and part of your profession is getting injured, unfortunately. And then the other side of that profession is coming back from those injuries, getting back to a level. And you have to be motivated. I'm certainly motivated to recover from the injury and do everything right to come back to the level I need to be at for 2021 for myself and for the team and for my friends in the team. So I honestly don't really know how to answer it. It's just, I guess, yeah, when I was young, I used to get banged around on a rugby field and things. And I, like any young kid, you sort of shrug off injuries and go, oh yeah, my leg's a bit sore, but run it off, walk it off, you know, the old saying. But as you get older and you become a professional cyclist, you realize you have to do certain things in a particular way to come back from injuries. And I think I always just give myself, the most important thing I've always done when I get injured or have to have surgeries or things is actually allow myself to feel shit and be like, I am disappointed by this. I know that it's going to be a long recovery. Don't hide the fact that you are disappointed, Sam. And I let myself feel like that. And I let myself be pissed off. And I let myself, you know, be upset and frustrated and annoyed. And I let myself do all that stuff, because I feel like if you do, you flush it out of the system. And then you go, right, I'm done with that stuff now. I'm done with the self-loathing. I'm done with the disappointment. Now I'm on to the next phase. From tomorrow onwards, let's go. Let's start doing it. And you can start then, because you've done all that stuff and you've left that behind you, you can easily push forward more, better than what you would if you didn't allow yourself to do that, because you'd be constantly going up and down, up and down, up and down. Yeah. But you've done it, and now it's one direction.
And is that also, I guess, what, I mean, you spoke earlier about now being somewhat of an elder, you know, statesman, if you like, in the team. To what extent is that also something you can bring to the younger riders? Because, you know, if you're talking to a Neo Pro who's experienced a crash or an injury, they may not be approaching it with the same kind of mindset or resolve that you can with the experiences that you've had. So, I mean, how do you see your role now with relation to the experiences that you've had through your life and your career as a cyclist, and then how you can, in a way, share or pass that knowledge on to others?
Yeah, I think it's an opportunity. And it's also something that I really enjoy, and something that I'm quite passionate about as I've grown older. I really do enjoy talking with the young guys and offering advice from my experiences or guidance in certain directions or giving my opinion on things. I really enjoy doing that. It's not a burden for me. It's actually something I choose to do. And I guess given the fact that I have had ups and downs in the sport, it gives me, you know, the vision to be able to say to these guys, look, it's going to happen, but there's certain ways that you can deal with it. And you have to manage each. I think it's really important to create relationships with these young guys if you are willing to help them or, you know, help them to give them guidance. Because if you create a relationship with these guys, you actually understand the person. And then you can manage. If you ever get in a situation where this young guy gets injured or this young guy gets injured, you know that they're going to look at this injury in a different way. One guy's going to take it hard. One guy's going to be like, ah, it's right. Let's just get stuck into it. Whereas someone else might really struggle. So if you have those relationships, you can identify those things, and then you can manage the person individually and help them through the situation that best suits them. And that's something that I really like to do. And I would like to continue to help young people, young bike riders for a long time, and not just recovering from injuries, but just in general.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say that, just in terms of that getting to know each other and having an insight into each other as people, because I mean, you know, I've had an interaction with many different pro teams over the course of my life and particularly in the last sort of 5-6 years, getting closer to the sport at that level. And I have to say, sometimes when I walk into a team and you step into a team bus, you just feel that the chemistry is not right, that the vibe is not right in terms of that bonding or connection or whatever it might be. I mean, what do you think it takes to actually create a real sense of, you know, not just sociability, not just, you know, guys liking each other and wanting to support each other, but also that kind of solidarity of purpose where people really want to pull in the same direction? Because, you know, obviously in some years in Green Edge, you really seem to have that chemistry nailed. What does it take from your experience to achieve that, to get that real sense of connection and shared direction?
I think the main thing is just buy-in, that everyone buys into what we're trying to achieve in Green Edge. And the when the team was formed in 2012, Jerry Ryan's vision was to create a team, successful cycling team, but not at the expense of a good culture. So that was always the format. That was always what everybody knew. When you came to Green Edge, whether it was in 2012 or 2020, you knew that this team was about culture. And everybody who comes to this team buys into that, and you have to buy into it. And then once you buy into the fact that this team is going to be about creating a good environment and all that and all those things, it's really important to have honest and open communication. It's important to be transparent, and it's important to acknowledge that although there is a hierarchy in the organization, like anything, that everybody has a voice, and everybody, yeah, there's not because you're the Neo Pro and he's the general manager that you have no voice. That's not how this operation works. You have to, yeah, if you're young and you're new to the team, it's important to like stay quiet and listen and learn and things. But you're also free to speak and offer your opinion. And when you have a good culture, and that's what this team's done really well, is we've held on to a lot of older guys who have been in the program from the start, and they're here for a reason, because they can then share experiences with those young guys. If the young guys want to talk, you're encouraged to talk. There's no right or wrong answer questions. Feel free to ask anything, ask away. And the bike riders and the directors and everybody around has got the same buy-in, and everyone has the same standing when it comes to sharing advice, sharing opinions, sharing knowledge. So that's really important. That number one is that you buy into what we're trying to do, and then everybody's has good, clear communication. Everyone's transparent, and everyone has the comfort within our bus, or, you know, we do call our bus our safe haven, where everyone can talk, everyone can say and do what they want in the meetings. And that might create an argument, it might not. If it does create an argument, we sort it out on the bus. When we get off, that's finished. It's done. It's sorted. It's resolved. Let's go to the dinner table and have a laugh.
Yeah. Yeah, great to hear. It's interesting that you say that, because I had I've had several conversations recently just talking about Adam Hansen recently, of course Matt Heyman, who was with you on Green Edge, Sven Tuft, another one of your teammates, and Tyler Hamilton, former American pro. And one of the interesting things there was that a common theme there was to say that actually that's not the way that it happens in all teams, right? That actually in Adam Hansen was talking about, I guess, the the old cultures where it is very much hierarchical, where it's top down and riders are told what to do and to basically not to to push back or to ask questions. I guess for me, that's a curious, right? Because it then comes to who makes the decisions, right? I mean, as you say, there's a DS who makes the decision. How does that interaction happen during a race? I mean, you've talked about having a debate on the bus or a, you know, an argument or whatever it might be, but what about when you're on the road and, you know, as maybe the road captain or one of the senior guys, you see stuff happening around you that maybe, you know, someone like a Matt White is not seeing in the car. How does that then occur, or how do you manage that when you feel that the situation you're in is maybe not being witnessed or understood by someone like a Matt White in a car? And then how do you make those decisions and interact with leadership in a situation like that?
Yeah, then it comes down to ownership, because in those situations, you will have a road captain that the sports director at the time, whether it be Whitey or someone else, that's, you know, they've chosen this person to be the road captain for this race because they trust that person. They trust that they're going to make the right decisions on the road. And that is often the case where the road captain needs to make a decision on the road because the sports director in the car, they can't see what's happening. And that's quite a simple resolution, because you basically just go, look, you know, guys, close that gap. Shut that gap down. We can't let Valverde go on the breakaway or whatever. You know, you make those decisions on the road quickly. The issue is when you get to a tactical decision where the sports director might say, hey, guys, there's a point in 60 kilometers time. We'll turn left and it's a crosswind. I want you guys to put it in the gutter. And then we might talk about it on the bike with the guys and we all go, I don't think that's the right decision. You know, it's not the right place, or for whatever reason, we don't feel like it's the right tactical decision. That's when it gets tricky, because then the road captain then needs to relay that to the sports director and essentially, in a way, try to override them, for lack of a better word, and say, look, mate, we're out here on the bike and we really don't feel like that's the right thing to do. You know, the way the peloton's moving, the way the guys are riding, we don't feel like that's the right decision. And that can sometimes create a discussion. And then at the end of the day, that's when the hierarchy would come in. And if the sports director was like, no, that is what we're doing, then ultimately you have to do it. But in this team, it doesn't happen a lot, because we do have that open communication. We do have that trust, and we do have that transparency where we can have those discussions. And then often the sports director will say, okay, guys, I really believe that we should do it, but you're out there on the road. If you don't feel like that's the right thing to do, you guys make the call. And then after that decision has been made one way or another, whether it works out in your favor or not, then the ownership has to fall on the person who made the decision. And if we say, no, we're not doing it, and we don't do it, and then all of a sudden someone else does it in that exact spot and we're in the fourth group and we walk onto the bus and the sport director goes, I told you, then you have to take ownership and go, yeah, we messed up, yeah. You know? And that is then when the safe haven of the bus, of the meeting, would then pay its dues, and you have that discussion on the bus and you iron it all out. And likewise with the sports director, if he tells us to do it and then we do it and it doesn't work, and then we take a right hand to 5k later and then we're in the third group because someone else did it, then they have to also take ownership. But it's a situation that doesn't arise a lot, because there is clear communication, there is transparency, and there is trust within the program, and there's always plenty of discussion. It's never that simple of this is what you're doing. You know, it's always like, guys, what do you think? And there's been open discussion, and between the two parties, car and bike, decision will be made.
Yeah, great. So Sam, you know, there's always a point in one's career, you know, whether it's on the bike or you know, in other fields of endeavor, where you think about what comes next, right? You've been so focused on your career as a bike rider for more than a decade, right? How do you think about the future, or to what extent have you thought about your future after your competitive career comes to an end?
It's difficult. It's really difficult. And I watched your show on the Detour with Dan, and you shared a sentiment that I agree 100% with, that when you're young and you're trying to become a professional, that's all you're thinking about. Then you come professional and then you're like, well, I've got, now I'm 23, I've just turned professional. you don't have to think about what's going to happen next because you're so young and you think, all right, let's just focus on being a pro bike rider. If it doesn't work out in 2 years' time, you're 25, you go to university, whatever. And then you get to the middle part of your career where you become a little bit more established and you feel a little bit safer in getting a contract the following year. So then you also think, right, I'm in the middle of my career now. I want to really make this count and I've got a job next year. And then you get to the end of your career and you go, oh, shit. Actually, this crept up on me. What am I going to do afterwards? But I think it is difficult. I guess coming back to me that, yeah, this lockdown gave me a chance to sort of see the other side of the coin a little bit. Although I was locked inside an apartment, I wasn't really being a pro bike rider to a sense because we were so limited as to what we could do. And that gave me an opportunity to think, oh, what can I do during this lockdown to keep myself busy? So I started a podcast, you know, things like that. And I was like, oh, I enjoy doing this. Maybe this is something I might want to do down the line. I started looking at different things I could study and all those things. And I don't know when my career is going to end. Hopefully not too soon, but it's certainly easier to acknowledge that I'm in the last part of my career. You know, I might be in the last quarter of my career. So at that point, you have to start thinking a little bit about, okay, what am I interested in doing? What am I passionate about? Whether it be a bike rider, whether it be I might want to be an electrician when I stop, you know, whatever that may be. But I also think like, I don't want to think too hard about it because I still want to focus on what my job is. And I guess the best thing I would say, when you're not sure about what you're going to do when you stop cycling, you're not sure when you're going to stop cycling, is to do some real simple fundamental things when you are a bike rider, because ultimately this is, for a lot of us, this is going to be the peak of our earnings, you know, when we stop, because this is, we're currently working in the sector that we're most qualified for. When we leave that sector, we're underqualified. And this is where we're going to make the most of our money. And it's only going to be for such a short period of time. So you can make just really simple things like that. Like make sure when I stop my career, I own a house. You know, make sure when I stop my career, I have some money set aside that if I don't know what I'm going to do, I can survive for 6 months. You know, you've got little investments. So there's a little bit of revenue coming in. You know, I'm not saying you have to be Warren Buffett, but like there's certain like small fundamental financial things you can do that can give you at least a little bit of a buffer when you stop your career to be like, okay, now, what am I going to do next?
Yeah. Great words of advice. And I think that's something that we're definitely going to take forward, that over the coming months, we're going to be offering some webinars and some videos actually on helping current and recently retired pros on thinking a little bit more about that transition, because it certainly seems to be something which is in need. And certainly with the way that the world's, you know, evolving right now. I mean, there will be quite a few people out of contract potentially in 2021 who didn't expect that, you know, in terms of a premature retirement. So we'll do what we can there. I mean, for you, Sam, though, I mean, if you think, you know, maybe 5 years, 6 years down the line, maybe longer, you know, when you have come to the end of your competitive career, how would you define success for yourself?
I guess I would up until now, I'm satisfied with how things have gone. I haven't won a lot of bike races myself. In fact, I've only won 3 bike races as a professional, and they've all been team time trials. So I've never raised my arms, but I'm okay with that, you know, because I still feel like I've had success. I've won Olympic medals. I've been part of winning teams and team time trials, and part of like really cool successes within the organization of Grand Tour podiums. Maddie Hayman winning Roubaix, I was there. So I've shared these cool experiences with these people. And for me to define my career at the end of it would be to say that I get to a point where I go, look, I'm really, really happy with what I've been part of. And I am a guy that really enjoys sharing the successes of other guys. And I really like to work hard and I'm motivated to do my part in helping that person have those successes. So I would just love to continue to do that. I'd love to go and win a grand tour with, obviously not myself. I can't climb good enough or time trial good enough or sprint good enough, but be part of a grand tour winning team and just try to leave the organization which I'm in now, Green Edge, which is an organization that I love, which I really feel like I'm at home, leave it in a better place than when I found it. You know, make the culture, when I leave, go like the culture I'm leaving behind is going to live forever, you know, sort of style. and the performance of the team is going to live forever and all that sort of thing. That's what would make me happy, leaving behind something that, leaving behind a legacy, I suppose, in a sense, and leaving behind a legacy that may not be a legacy of 150 victories, but a legacy of a guy that gave everything for the team, who was part of successes, and he really bought into the to what our organization and what our team's about.
Sam, that's great. Thanks a lot. And that makes a lot of sense. I think, you know, all too often, we narrowly define success as being the guy who's putting his or her hands up on the podium, or the person who has the biggest, job title on the business card or whatever it might be. But I think, you know, what you've just described is super important, which is, you know, success is not often what we achieve as individuals, but it's the success that we're a part of and being a part of something bigger. And especially if you can create not only success in the short term, but you can create a success that sustains, you know, after you are gone, then that's super important. And I guess the other thing that I sense from you throughout this talk actually is that, you know, I've heard it from many people, you know, about how positive an influence you are in the team, how you're able to raise people up, to get the best out of others. And for me, you know, that's leadership, right? I mean, that's what we call leadership. And yet all too often we think of leadership being as the title or the person who is at the top of the hierarchy. Whereas I think a lot of what we've heard today is about leading from wherever you are, right? Whether you're at the top of the hierarchy or you're one of the team members or a worker, that leadership can happen anywhere. I mean, just to finish, Sam, I mean, you're someone who obviously has had the courage to pursue your dream, right? I mean, that you've had that dream since you, as you said, you were a teenager. But all too often, you know, people have that dream, but they don't follow through with it for one reason or another. I mean, what would be your advice to someone who's either a young person, you know, thinking about pursuing this dream to become a professional athlete, or maybe someone even in their 40s or 50s who are dreaming about, you know, pursuing a new path for themselves in life? You know, what advice would you give to people to have the courage or the commitment, I guess, to just go for it?
Yeah, I think pursuing any dream at whatever age or of life or whatever industry you may be talking about, there's always a risk factor. And at the end of the day, you have to be sure that you have the tools or the whatever you need to make that dream work. You know, you can't just go like, I can't just wake up tomorrow morning and go, oh, I'm going to be a Formula One driver. You know, of course, I don't have the tools to be a Formula One driver. I'll never be a Formula One driver. But if you have the tools and the passion and you really feel like you can do it and whatever you want to do, then you have to back yourself and then you just have to take the risk and just go for it. Because, I mean, it was I did that in a sense. I took the risk and went to Europe when I was 18 years old. And it might not have worked out, but I guess it was an easier risk to take because I was still only 18 years old. So if it didn't work out, then it was easy to realign. Okay, maybe it's not so easy when you're a little bit older, or you may be in a pretty safe environment, you know, in your industry, and you might have regular income and you might have, you know, 10 days of holidays a year and all that stuff. But ultimately, if you're not enjoying it and you feel like, I really want to try this, if you have the tools then and you back yourself and you're confident you can do it, then take the risk. Have a stab, I suppose.
That's great. Terrific, terrific advice, Sam. Look, this has been a fascinating conversation. I think we've covered a lot of bases, but certainly I had expectations coming into the chat, having heard so many good things about you. And Sam, this has really exceeded my expectations in terms of, you know, the depth of your wisdom and the, you know, the really, I think, practical advice that you've been able to offer people. And that advice is not just obviously for people who ride bikes, but I think the advice that you offer is really relevant for anyone who has a dream or has that desire to pursue something that they're curious or they're passionate about. So Sam Bewley, thanks a lot for this interview. For those of you who have been watching, of course, if you have liked the video, please do give us the thumbs up. And of course, please do subscribe to the This Cycling Life YouTube channel. So Sam Bewley, thanks again.
Thank you very much, mate. Enjoyed it.